Welcome to Stand in the Gap Today with Sam Rohr, Gary Dahl, and David Kistler of the American Pastors Network, addressing the most critical issues impacting our culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Learn more about the work of the American Pastors Network at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net.
Well, while the U.S. consumer sentiment is at a 13-year high, and I wonder where yours is, ladies and gentlemen, what that means is 94.5 million citizens, even though the sentiment is at an all-time high, that many number of people are still, according to the numbers, unable to find work. These are people who are capable, looking for jobs, but they can't find it. Consumer spending is also down according to these latest numbers. Now, on top of this, we continue a very long history of living above our means as a nation. U.S. trade deficit, as an example, continues to balloon, having reached an annualized rate of $750 billion. That's the worst since 2007. And the national debt, the other number, what we owe ourselves and others, including unfunding obligations, when you put that all together, works out to $1.5 million to $1.7 million for every working American. So if you felt some pressure, ladies and gentlemen, there's a reason for that. Now, today, we're going to talk about this in this first segment with our special guest, John DeSantis. He is an attorney with DeSantis and Croft, and he's an advisor also with Grandview Asset Management in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I'm going to talk with him in this first segment about these things, what we can do about it, if anything, as individuals in the face of these kinds of economic factors. And then for segment 2, 3, and 4, we're going to invite in E.J. Kimball. He's the director of the Israel Victory Fund, and he's going to talk to us about why the Israel Victory Fund exists. He's going to talk to us about upcoming visits by a couple of members of the Israeli Knesset, why they're coming to America. And we're going to also talk about Saudi Arabia and their order this morning, their mandate order to all Saudi citizens living in Lebanon to get out immediately, and whether or not that's a telegraphing of imminent war in the Middle East. So we're going to have all of this and more. And with that, I welcome you to the program. I'm Sam Rohr. Our other regular co-hosts, Dave and Gary, are both gone today. So let's go right now, immediately, if we can, to our first guest, John DeSantis. He is with Grandview Asset Management. And John, let me start here with you, if I can. These numbers I gave as an example, U.S. consumer sentiment, 13-year high, yet 94.5 million citizens, just under a third of all U.S. citizens say they can't find jobs, trade deficit, $750 billion, working out to an average debt load for every working person, $1.5 billion to $1.7 billion. These are incredible things, and I want you to put them into perspective for us as we look at this. The president's tax cuts and what's being discussed right now are being put out as both a nice idea, in some cases, say, a necessary idea. In light of these kind of figures, are these tax cuts necessary? And in your opinion, will they actually help, or what will they do?
Well, first, Sam, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. In my opinion, the tax cuts are absolutely necessary. I think the engine of the American economy has always been small business, and I think these tax cuts would strengthen that sector of the economy. And those are the people that live across the street from you, the people that you meet in the grocery store. Those are the people that are putting Americans to work and creating wealth in this economy and in this country. So absolutely, yes, I think the tax cuts are necessary. You raise a good point, of course, with the deficit. So the question is, can you pass tax cuts and possibly increase the deficit? Will that strengthen the economy? You know, I'm an old Reagan Republican, and I think it can be done. I think it was done in the 80s, and I think it can be done now with this bill.
Okay, now, John, you've been around long enough to know how these things go. There's a desire out there, the narrative, we need tax cuts. Now, there are some on the leftist side of the economic perspective who say, you can't do that, it's going to raise the deficit. In my opinion, as you said, most of them have been very guilty of raising the deficit, and they don't care. But now they think it's an issue. Now, at this point, you've had a bill come out of the House, you've had a bill come out of the Senate. There are differences. That's not abnormal. It's the way it works. But I do see two distinctive differences, at least. The Senate version right now in order to simplify the code, has foregone all deductions, local deductions, including property taxes, which would really make a big deal in California, as an example, but also income taxes. Well, I'm sitting in Pennsylvania. You happen to be right now. Property taxes are a big part here, too. The House, though, has those deductions in place. My question to you, how important is it for those local deductions, such as income tax or property tax, to be kept in whatever final tax bill we may see?
Well, I think certainly to lessen the deficit, the impact that it may have on our national debt, I think those caps will need to remain in place. And I would ask you, Sam, I mean...
What do you mean those caps? Caps for what? What caps?
Deductions, for example, I think if you're going to allow up to $10,000 for property taxes...
Okay.
Anything above and beyond that, you'll no longer be able to write off or deduct. I think that's an appropriate approach, to be quite honest. Because, I mean, my question to you, Sam, and to the audience is, why should people who are living in states such as Wyoming or Colorado, states that have been fiscally conservative and have carefully planned and have low property taxes, why should those states and those individuals have to subsidize places like New Jersey, California, New York, where the spending has been out of control for generations and where the property taxes are sky high? So personally, I think that the capping the deduction at $10,000 would be appropriate. I think it would I think it would reward those individuals in states that have been fiscally conservative and have kept property taxes at a minimum.
And John, I think that's a great point that you made, because it also underscores why it's so difficult to get one thing that fits everybody across the country. In this case, you're talking federal tax, but you do have a lot of variances between the states, and I think that's a very, very good point. Let me ask you another one here in the remaining time. The president wants these tax cuts passed by Christmas. There's a lot of fussing and fuming going on. Do you think it's going to happen, and what happens if it does not get passed by Christmas, in your opinion?
Well, Sam, you know, as a Republican, I've been very frustrated with what's been going on in D.C. and what's been going on with my Congress. And if they don't cooperate and work with this president to pass a tax plan, I think there will be quite a reckoning in the next cycle, election cycle. So I think that do I think it's going to pass by Christmas? I've been around too long. I'm a little bit skeptical that it will happen that quickly, but it needs to happen, and I think it will happen.
All right, John DeSantis, he's an attorney with DeSantis and Croft in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, also an advisor with Grandview Asset Management. John, thanks for being with us today here. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We're going to come back. We're going to welcome in a guest, E.J. Kimball. He is the director of Israel Victory Project. We're going to talk about why that exists. We're going to talk about a host of things that we're going to learn from Israel, and we're ultimately going to talk about whether or not Saudi Arabia is going to lead the Middle East into war.
Americans are a freedom-loving people. Wouldn't it be great if you could carry a copy of the essential documents that outline our freedoms written by our nation's founders in your pocket so you can refer to it every day? Well, now you can. Stand in the Gap Radio has found something you're sure to like. The Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide. The handy guide is a slim 6.5 by 3.5 inches, yet it includes the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the preamble to the Bill of Rights, and other influential documents, including, in the words of our founders, topical quotes from America's founders, plus a listing of online resources for further research by the serious-minded or the just plain curious. To see and request your copy of the Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide and make your tax-deductible gift of any amount, go to AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. Let us hear from you today. Thank you, and God bless you.
Hello, this is Sam Rohr. Although the term Christian education doesn't occur in the Bible, it does speak of the moral and spiritual instruction of children. It places a high value on knowledge, both of God and His works. It describes the moral and spiritual fruits of this knowledge and defines its ultimate purpose, the growth of your child in godliness of character and action. That's why we suggest you consider BJU Press K-12 materials. Your child's a unique individual created for a specific purpose. Proper instruction that includes the Bible and the relational influence
influence of godly teachers produces a pure heart and a willing mind. The Bible calls that success. BJU Press materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. They teach critical thinking skills and keep your child engaged and excited about learning. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit BJUPress.com. That's BJUPress.com.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website, AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
Well, the Middle East, ladies and gentlemen, is indeed about to erupt in an all-out conflict driven by the hatred of Iran and its shills, including terrorist groups like Hezbollah and the Palestinian hate groups like Hamas and Fatah and others. One thing these Islamic-inspired terrorist nations and groups have in common is their absolute rejection of the right of Israel to exist as a nation. And because of that, in connection with that, they also hate the United States about as much as they hate Israel. But things happen, and that's what pulls the United States historically and Israel together. So from here on through the balance of the program today, we're going to talk with E.J. Kimball. He is the director of the Israel Victory Project, about this hatred and why the Israel Victory Project exists. Now, I understand you probably have never heard of this group. I didn't either until some time ago. But I thought it was important that you, as our listeners, understand who they are and what they're doing. Then we are, as I have set up, we're going to dig deeper as to why Saudi Arabia this morning ordered all of their citizens out of Lebanon and whether or not, in fact, that is a telegraphing of an imminent outbreak there in the Middle East. So this and a whole lot more. So with that, I want to welcome E.J. Kimball to Stand in the Gap today. E.J., thanks for taking time from your schedule to be with us.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for having me, Sam.
E.J., it's been a pleasure for me to get to know you a little bit. I'm anxious to hear more about you, and particularly your function there with the Israel Victory Project. Let me start out by asking this question to you. What is the Israel Victory Project, and why was it started? Why is it necessary?
So the Israel Victory Project is a project of the Middle East Forum, which is an organization based in Philadelphia. And the idea behind the Israel Victory Project is one that the president and founder, Daniel Pipes, has written about for nearly 20 years. And it's based on the premise that wars end when, not when one side wins, but when one side gives up its objective, when one side loses. And if you take the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and go back to modern history in 1947 with the partition plan and the rejection of the creation of a Jewish state, that is the crux of the problem that we face today and why the conflict continues. So the idea behind the Israel Victory Project is to take a new view, to create a new paradigm in resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to move away from the last 25 years of the Oslo process of land for peace, and to go to the root of this ideological element, which is the right of a Jewish state to exist.
All right, so what I said to you when I introduced it was that there are those Islamic-based hate groups who do not believe Israel has a right to exist. Let me take that one step further with you. I said Islamic connected because that's who we hear from the most, but there are other people who don't think that Israel has a right to exist either. I mean, I know there have been efforts out of that United Nations and others who really don't like an independent nation of Israel, and they've worked for a long time at frustrating every effort to try to do anything in order to make that happen. If you look at those who are most strongly opposed to the nation of Israel, what ideology is that? And perhaps what nations or what nations and groups would represent those most strongly hostile to the nation of Israel?
It's a very interesting question that you ask because it can go in a few ways. You mentioned about the, you mentioned Islamic countries. There's a doctrine followed by the fundamentalist jihadi groups that Hamas, Hezbollah, and some others that believe that any land that was once conquered by Islam must always be controlled by Islam. So therefore, recognizing Israel as a Jewish state is problematic to their doctrinal core beliefs. That's one set. But, you know, you brought up a bigger picture, which is some non-Islamic countries also seem to reject the Jewish nature of the state of Israel. And I heard Charles Krauthammer speak about this a few years ago, and he made a very interesting point that in the history of the world, when people are conquered, they tend to be dispersed, they assimilate into the population that conquered them, and they cease to exist from history. You don't hear about the ancient Celtic people looking to reestablish a country today. But the Jewish people, the state of Israel, the Jewish people who were dispersed, after 2,000 years, came back to their land. And there's no precedent to go to say this is just like the time that something else had happened. And it's just hard for people to wrap their heads around that this is actually a people who have come back to the land that they were dispersed from.
I think that's a great point that you're making, because that is historically the first time that's happened. And it's the first time that not only that a people dispersed have come back, but also to resurrect a spoken language, Hebrew, that has not been spoken. That's also, I mean, EJ, comment on this, because when I look at the history of Israel since 1948 and the coming back and all that's happened, I often use the words, as other people do, that they are there against all odds. It makes no human sense that they're back in the land. And I look, as a Christian, and on this program we talk a lot about biblical worldview, well, we're very much fixated and supportive of Israel because we say it's a miracle, God did it, that Israel is back in the land. From my perspective, you can disagree with me if you like, but from my sense is that part of the reason why some of these atheist nations and others who don't like Israel, it has to do a lot with their view of God as much as anything. What are your thoughts?
I agree with your sentiment that it's a miracle that the Jewish people have come back to Israel and that the state itself exists, which obviously is not just a state for Jewish people. It accommodates people of all faiths or no faiths, providing them with religious freedoms that are unseen in that part of the world for a minority religion in society. You know, the Six-Day War in 1967 is something that is studied by militaries across the world, including the United States, to see just how they were able to achieve this, because it defies all logic. If you look at reports at the time that that war was about to happen, you know, the state of Israel was about to be destroyed. And the fact that not only did it survive the war, but it thrived and it won and drove these Arab countries, you know, back into submission in that war was nothing short of a miracle.
Yep, it was. And I tell you, that's an amazing, amazing thing. In the last closing minutes here of this segment, I wanted to ask you this as well. You are being the Israel Victory Project is hosting two members of the Israeli Knesset who will be visiting here in the United States this next week. Why are they coming and why are you facilitating their involvement here? Can you share with that?
Sure. In April of this year, the Middle East Forum helped support the creation in the United States Congress of a Congressional Israel Victory Caucus, chaired by Congressman Ron DeSantis and Congressman Bill Johnson. And in July, we helped facilitate the creation in the Knesset of the Knesset Israel Victory Caucus, chaired by Knesset member Oded Forer from the Yisrael Beitenu Party, who will be here, and Yaakov Peri from the Yesh Atid Party. He will not be on this visit, but Knesset member Avraham Nagosa from the Likud party will be here as well. And the idea behind these caucuses is to build to create a discussion to build this new narrative towards ending the conflict, ending the unnecessary bloodshed, and bringing peace to a part of the world that desperately needs it. So the Middle East Forum is bringing these two Knesset members over. We'll be spending a day in New York. We'll be at Columbia University Monday evening. We will also be in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday and Wednesday next week, having a meeting with the members of the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus, with bipartisan groups of members of Congress, as well as community leaders, and holding an event open to the public on Capitol Hill That event is almost at capacity at the moment with a few seats left. But, you know, the really important part of this is to bring the message from the Israeli side of what does Israel want? How does Israel view this conflict and the ways forward to actually resolving it? What steps do they want to take that they believe can end the conflict? Because for 25 years, we've given the Palestinian side the ability with all the resources that they could possibly need to end this rejectionism of Israel, to accept the legitimacy of the Jewish state, and they haven't. So it's time for a new paradigm. It's time for a new way forward. And it's very important for decision makers in the United States to hear from the Israeli side of what they think can help move this process forward.
Hmm. Well, the creation of that dialogue is something that's obviously very, very, very critical, EJ. I mean, I'm looking forward to what happens as a result of what you're doing here this next year. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we talked about the conflict in the Middle East. We talked about this effort by Middle East Forum and the Israel Victory Caucus to help bridge that and bring a resolve to that in the Middle East. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about Israel with E.J. Kimball of Israel Victory Project, and we're going to swing back a little bit into New York City and the terrorist attack that was up there, but we're going to connect it to Israel. What can we learn from Israel about how they've dealt with terrorist attacks, about what we could learn here, and how we should better deal with them here? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website, AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to welcome you back if you are just joining us, particularly those on the East Coast listening live and other places. This may be at your lunch break. We understand that, and we are thrilled that you are making us a part of your day. If you are just picking us up, though, or have to leave at some point, remember that you can always listen to the entirety of the program in one of two places. One, going to our website at standinthegapradio.com. You can pick up the archive of this program and all of our programs on all three that we have. And then if you have an iPhone or an Android and you haven't downloaded our free app yet, I would strongly encourage you to do that. Very easy. Just go to your app store and enter the phrase Stand in the Gap. Just Stand in the Gap. Put it in. Download the app. You can listen then at your convenience. And you can communicate to us. We can communicate to you, which we do, with alerts about who the guest will be and the theme of the program. And you can come alongside and help us financially as well, helping us to expand the reach of this program even more so across the country. Now, our guest in this segment we're talking to is E.J. Kimball. He is the director of the Israel Victory Project. It's a project of the Middle East Forum based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. E.J., I want to go back to you now. Let's go down a different direction here. I set it up that we perhaps could learn some things from Israel relative to the terrorist attack. Probably no one is more used to terrorist attacks than Israel from the very beginning, and not even just one at a time, but entire nations, as you said, 1968, rose up against this nation, and somehow they've survived. Now, you used the word miracle. I've used it because I think it is, but also they have some practical things that they have done and have observed and how to deal with particularly Islamic terrorists, because that's where most of them come from, out of that ideology. Well, New York City had a terrorist attack, we know. If you could look at New York, what happened there, or Las Vegas, wherever, and look at those things based on what Israel has learned, are there some applicable lessons that we could learn that would help us here in this nation to better prepare for terrorist attacks?
Certainly, and I had mentioned to you prior to this interview, I've recently just returned from Israel. I was there a couple weeks ago with a group called the Advanced Security Training Institute, which brings U.S. first responders over to Israel for a week-long training program to learn from the Israelis on how they respond. Now, clearly, in how they prepare and respond. And of course, it's a different situation. Israel is a significantly smaller country than the United States. But there are lessons that can be learned from the Israeli side that can be applied here. And you know, there's two specific that come to mind from that trip. The first one is when an attack happens in Israel, if a shooting happens at a cafe, if a bus is blown up, within hours, that scene is cleared and open for business. People continue living. They're right back in that spot. They're not lingering on it. Of course, there's the mourning period, and there's a lot that society does to deal with the pain from the attacks, but they don't let it cripple their daily lives. And it's a very important point, because what are these terrorist attacks trying to do? They're trying to get into your psyche. They're trying to change your way of life, to change how you act. So that's one very important lesson that I learned. The other really important lesson is that historically, these terrorist groups, these jihadi groups, when they carry out an attack, they want to get maximum media attention. But once you do an attack once, if you do it the second time, it doesn't have that same impact. It doesn't have that same wow factor. So, you know, on 9/11, they flew planes, you know, into buildings and, you know, unprecedented, unexpected. We haven't had an attack like that again, and a lot of that has been because of work that our government has taken to stop it. But there's also been a few types of attacks on planes that we've been fortunate have not worked, specifically the one some years ago, about 10 years ago or so, over Detroit on Christmas Day, when a plane was about to be blown up, but the person did not have the right materials. That was the underwear bomber. That was a failure of the intelligence community, but that was a different type of attack. And in Israel, what they explained was, you can keep trying to go back and figure out how to stop a previous attack from happening again, which is necessary, and we need to do it. But you're not going to be able to stop everything, and we need to be anticipating where they're going to go next. And one thing that I've seen over the years in my work is that they tend to use Europe and Asia as testing grounds for tactics.
That's an incredible comment that you're making right there, and I'm just going to step in here. Those two things that you mentioned, I think, are pretty brilliant. After an attack in Israel, they get things back to normal as quickly as possible. That's something I would say doesn't happen here too as much. That's a great one. And then the other one you said is that the terrorists, because they are seeking media attention and the wow factor, as you put it, are not as inclined to repeat the same thing exactly the same. Now, in this country, we tend to be so reactionary that we build monumental changes in people's lives to prevent the same thing from happening again. But that kind of goes counter to what you're saying that Israel has done all along. Why is that? Are we still, in your opinion, not understanding who the enemy is properly? Perhaps it's why we've been responding generally the way we are? Talk about that.
Well, to take your second question first, the answer is yes, we haven't quite still 16 years after 9/11, and of course this didn't start on 9/11, but we still have not accurately identified the threat that we're facing. We have not accurately identified the enemy that we're fighting against, which is why, if you see on the battlefield, we've won every battle. If you look at Afghanistan, if you look at when we were in Iraq before we withdrew, we won every battle. Yet, I don't think you could point to Afghanistan or Iraq and say that we've won the war. And we haven't won the war because we don't understand the ideological nature of the enemy that we're fighting. And on the Israeli side, you know, they're in a different situation. They don't have the choice of withdrawing. If they withdraw, that's the end of Israel. So they're engaged in this 24/7. They don't have the option of withdrawing. And they need to be proactive. I mean, you know, going back to this victory concept, can you imagine if in 1947 with the partition plan that the Arab representatives said, okay, we're okay with the Jewish state being created? Think about all the technological advancements that Israel has made since out of necessity for survival, that who knows what would have ended up happening, but I doubt that we would have the technological advancements today if the Arab states in 1947 had just said yes.
You know what, EJ? That's a great, great thought. I mean, we've often heard that phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. That's exactly what you're saying right there. That's a great thing. Well, let's just stay there now in Israel. Let me go to just a slight different direction here. Let's just talk about it. Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Not only are the nations around Israel, many of them, don't want Israel to exist as a nation, they really don't want Jerusalem as the capital. And yet there is talk of, the president said ultimately, President Trump ultimately said he wanted to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Can you tell us what's the latest on that change? Are we ever going to see anything in our lifetime of Jerusalem becoming the official capital of Israel?
Well, Jerusalem is the official capital of Israel. The question will become, when does the United States officially recognize that as the capital of Israel? Mm. And I attended a hearing on Wednesday chaired by Congressman Ron DeSantis, the chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee on National Security and co-chair of the Israel Victory Caucus. And he was addressing this point about moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is a component of this concept of victory, which is for the Palestinians to understand that you can't keep rejecting Israel and expect to get things. That's been the approach of the international community for the last 25 years, which is if you just give the Palestinians more, they'll eventually come to an agreement. But of course, it's the opposite. If you keep giving them more, you're reinforcing this bad behavior, which leads to the conflict being further from resolution than it was when the Oslo Accords started. So I think Ambassador Bolton said it right at the hearing. There's the argument made that Jordan doesn't want the embassy moved, Egypt doesn't want it moved, and if it's moved, it's going to cause these problems with all these surrounding countries. And he said, first of all of our embassies around the world are under threat. There are constant threats on our embassies all the time, and we have security there to prevent attacks from succeeding. Why would it be any different in Jerusalem? Second, our foreign policy, our decision-making, should not be held hostage to what other countries want. And that is the most important point that I think came out of it, which is we're the United States of America. We're supposed to be leading the world, not taking direction from others.
Great, great, great point, E.J. Kimball. Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking to E.J. Kimball. He's the director of the Israel Victory Project. Now, we're talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about the Palestinians. We talk about the fact that they hate Israel. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, when they announced this morning ordering all of their citizens out of Lebanon. Was that basically an announcement of an impending war? Because that's where the Palestinians are, and there's problems there. We're going to talk about what's actually happening or will happen.
Christian parents want their children to excel in spiritual growth and educational achievement. Both are essential for future success in an increasingly complex world full of moral and economic challenges. BJU Press Materials place great value on the knowledge of God in His works. They teach critical thinking skills your child will need to get along both now and in the future. BJU Press Materials are available for grades K-12. From the earliest grades, they teach biblical Christianity as a system of God-revealed truths. BJU Press Materials are well-written, grade-level appropriate, and biblically integrated. Teachers' editions assure that instructors have the plans and extra tools to keep your child engaged and excited about learning by teaching your child how to analyze, evaluate, and ultimately create new solutions. And that's just what today's workplace is looking for. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Jimmy DeYoung in Jerusalem, Israel. You often hear me on Stand in the Gap Today with Sam, Dave, and Gary. Guess what? We're all coming to Israel. Love to have you come and go with us. The dates are March the 7th through the 21st. That will include 10 days in Israel, 4 days in Petra, one of the most unique cities in all the world. If you need more information, the itinerary, the exact dates, also the information about cost, call this number, 423-825-6247. That's 423-825-6247. Ask for Jody. She can give you all the information as Stand in the Gap Today and Prophecy Today go host a tour to Israel. Next year in Jerusalem, we're looking forward to you being here with us.
Americans are a freedom-loving people. Wouldn't it be great if you could carry a copy of the essential documents that outline our freedoms written by our nation's founders in your pocket so you can refer to it every day? Well, now you can. Stand in the Gap Radio has found something you're sure to like, the Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide. The handy guide is a slim 6.5 by 3.5 inches, yet it includes the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the preamble to the Bill of Rights, and other influential documents, including, in the words of our founders, topical quotes from America's founders, plus a listing of online resources for further research by the serious-minded or the just plain curious. To see and request your copy of the Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide and make your tax-deductible gift of any amount, go to AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. Let us hear from you today. Thank you, and God bless you.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website. AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
Well, did the Saudis just announce an imminent Middle East war? This morning, when I got up, I heard on the news, as I listen every day, try to say, what are we going to cover in the program? It was revealed that Saudi Arabia ordered all Saudi citizens living in or visiting Lebanon to get out. Now, the question is, why did they do it? So I asked the question. I'm going to ask it to E.J. Kimball, who's my guest here today. Did the Saudis just telegraph an imminent Middle East war? So, E.J., the shakeup in the kingdom, the Saudi kingdom, there by 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, continues to unfold. And there's a lot of speculation about what the real reason is. He's saying he's doing it to bring in corruption. He's doing it to moderate Islamic ideology and all of that kind of thing. And I dispute that, frankly. But on the other hand, it is very clear that the Saudis are afraid of Iran. And they believe that if they don't do something soon, Iran is going to subdue them. That's been developed. And we know recently that the leader in Lebanon went to Saudi Arabia and then resigned his position due to the fear that he would be killed by Iranian supporters in Lebanon if he did it there. Now the Saudi leadership has ordered the citizens out. So I set the groundwork for you a little bit. You can go kind of where you want to, but ultimately this is the question. Did the Saudis just telegraph an imminent Middle East war that's going to focus on, obviously, some degree impacting Lebanon?
I think the most honest answer is we don't know. I think if you claim to know what exactly is going on there, you are either in violation of multiple agreements or you're making it up, because in that part of the world, especially right now, there are so many actors involved and there's so many activities taking place that to understand the motives are quite difficult to nail down. I think it's important to think about Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. You know, he's very young, and there is the potential that, you know, the arrests that have been made, that these actions being taken is a way to cement his hold on power to become the king. That's certainly something that is reasonable and possible. I also think that most people focus on Iranian influence in the region and the creation of this Shia crescent from Iran to the doorstep of Israel. That everyone is focused on the threat that Iran poses to Israel, which clearly it does, and clearly it is a threat that needs to be addressed, and the Israelis are very focused on it. But where a lot of people miss on the analysis is the Iranian crescent, the Shia crescent, is also focusing and surrounding Saudi Arabia, which, as you know, is the location of the two holiest sites in Islam, in Mecca and Medina. And that is a point that cannot be understated. That, to me, is the number one objective of the Iranian regime, of the Shia, of the battle between Shiism and Sunniism, is control over the two holiest sites, Mecca and Medina. And
So, EJ, you're suggesting there I mean, I want to put words in your mouth, but are you suggesting that the Iranian motivation, put it that way, is more centered on the subduing of Saudi Arabia and their influence because of the two holy sites being there, and secondarily on Israel? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think they are 1A and 1B. I think
okay.
They are both objectives, and they are working towards both at the same time. But to the part that gets all of the attention is the threat to Israel. And so to understand the Saudi motives and why Saudi Arabia feels so threatened with, say, the Houthis in Yemen, given that it's an area that Saudi Arabia has been at war in some capacity for years now, that there is a direct threat to Saudi control over the two holiest sites in Islam. And, you know, what recently happened with the ballistic missile fired at Riyadh from Yemen, the U.S. Air Force confirmed that this was an Iranian-manufactured ballistic missile. So if there was any doubt over Iran's influence and activity in Yemen, this seems to put it to bed, and that it means that this was a direct attack on the Saudi kingdom.
So that's why some articles I've read, they've basically said it was a declaration of war, some of the statements from Saudi Arabia have said. And there are some that are saying that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is a war hawk, meaning that he is, well, not so afraid to tackling with it. And some are saying that the Trump administration has basically said, hey, look, guys, kind of go for it. I don't know if you can comment on that or not, but clearly what's happening there in Lebanon with Hamas and Hezbollah and so forth, you're saying that crescent is a 1A threat to Saudi Arabia, but it's a 1B threat to Israel. So it's both in Israel's interest and Saudi Arabia's interest to reduce that Iranian threat that sits there in Lebanon and beyond. Who do you think may make the first move, Israel or Saudi Arabia? Or if you can't say, that's fine too, but what's your guess?
Well, I think what this has done, I will answer that question, but in a different way. I think what has happened as a result of the JCPOA, known as the Iran deal, which I think was a extremely poor deal on so many levels, what it has had the unintended consequence is it has brought Israel into an alliance of convenience with Saudi Arabia and some of these other Sunni Arab states. I don't want to say that they're at a state of peace. I think it is well understood that still there are significant problems in the relationship between the two countries. But they now have a common threat that they are addressing, and the cooperation between the two countries is unprecedented. What's happening in Lebanon right now is helping to actually clear the picture to understand that Lebanon is essentially now a state controlled by Iran through its proxy Hezbollah. So Israel for years now has been facing a growing threat since the last war in Lebanon in 2006, that Hezbollah now has over 100,000 rockets aimed at Israel that, based on the reports that I've seen, can reach almost any place in Israel. And Israel is going to face a very significant PR battle, because what Hezbollah has done in southern Lebanon, in violation of the UN resolutions that were passed, is they have built houses for the residents in southern Lebanon with the condition that a rocket launcher is in the house. So when the next war breaks out and they start firing rockets from these houses, Israel will have the dilemma of protecting their citizens or protecting the civilian lives in southern Lebanon. And of course, the responsibility of the Israeli government is to protect its citizens. And Hezbollah and Iran will be using human shields in southern Lebanon. But yet from the international view, of course, the Israeli side will be viewed as killing innocent civilians. And this is a well-known problem that the United Nations has been aware about for at least the last 4 years that I know of, because I was involved in a letter being sent to the UN Secretary General about this. So we're at a point now where the picture is getting clearer about the players in the field, and how we move forward is really going to be the big test of the Crown Prince.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you got a great inside story there on what's happening. And as E.J. Kimball, who's the director of Israel Victory Project, says, we don't really know what's going to take place, but it is coming to a head. And it's just perhaps what Saudi Arabia said is a precursor. Bottom line is, stay tuned for what is happening and be aware. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for being with us today as we close out this week. We encourage you, stay alert. Stay focused and stand in the gap for truth where you are. We'll see you back on Monday.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Stand in the Gap today with Sam Rohr, Gary Dahl, and David Kistler. Brought to you by the American Pastors Network. Every day on this station, we address the most urgent issues undermining the culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. APN takes seriously the command to be salt and light in this culture. Our mission is to declare truth into the public square, bringing a biblical worldview to the issues of the day. We seek to build a dynamic network of pastors across the nation who hold firmly to the authority of Scripture and boldly preach the whole counsel of God. This ministry is supported through the prayers and financial support of people like you, and we urge you to do all you can to help the American Pastors Network accomplish this mission. To learn more, visit www.AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. and help us with your donation today. Find out how we're impacting the culture and how you can join in the mission.
If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. WFYL reminds you to pray for America.